Now back to the second half of World Watchers. On the anniversary of Watergate, what I'm trying to show for you and will in the next half hour, maybe for the next few weeks, is that there was this internal rearrangement in the Intelligence Department, in the State Department, in the National Security Council, and Henry Kissinger had moved himself into the White House and then was invited to become Secretary of State. And after the Watergate tapes began to unfold, Richard Nixon was out and Alexander Haig was really running the country. Now, Alex Butterfield was in Australia. He was a member of a military family, third-generation military man. His grandfather was a West Pointer, his father a Navy pilot. He worked with Alexander Haig, and he was down in Australia at the time that Nixon came to power. And Haig brought him up to the White House, where he very conveniently taped the President of the United States. Now, you remember that the Supreme Court said that Richard Nixon should turn over 9 tapes, and then there were 7, and then there was unintelligible. And they brought in a fellow, Gordon Novell, to electronically erase tapes. And Robert Haldeman took tapes home. And, of course, that would erase any mention. It's funny, in all these tapes, you know, the Kissinger and the Haig role in this. But as Richard Nixon began to look sillier and sillier and got phlebitis and went to the hospital, Alexander Haig left his role in the Pentagon. He had worked with the U-2 flight over the Soviet Union, the Gary Powers flight with Alan Dulles. That was the flight, Lee Harvey Oswald was in the Soviet Union at the Minsk radio factory, and Gary Powers thought he had a role in downing that. That broke off the d'entente, the rapprochement between Khrushchev and Eisenhower. It was a terrible event of American history. Every time there's a chance for peace, the same team are always there, and Alexander Haig was there. So all of a sudden, at the hearings, the Senate hearings, Mr. Butterfield steps forward, July 13th, 1973, and they asked him, Judge Sirica, did you in fact tape the presidents? So that Butterfield, with his military background of 3 generations, and he also was put in charge of Federal Aviation to investigate the Dorothy Hunt plane crash, when the main primary witness went falling in the sky over Chicago, and her name appears in the early tapes over and over again. Butterfield was brought in by Haig. He bugged the president and tape recorded, and I'm sure, as I say, to their own convenience, could raise what they didn't want. Alexander Haig, by way of those tapes, eased the president out. The president didn't trust Spiro Agnew, so he had Gerry Ford come in. Gerry Ford had been called by the president to go to Wright Patman, who deceased shortly afterwards, and they were going to open up the banking connections, and Gerry was called in to cover that. And his reward, of course, for all the years from being on the Warren Commission and covering the murder of John Kennedy and all this can of worms that were in the White House at the time, because all these people went back to the murder of John Kennedy, and they're all sitting there making this smooth transition of power of the German Henry Kissinger, his mentor Fritz Kramer. I did many, many weeks this past year on Fritz Kramer, and I'll be doing a lot more in the next weeks to come for you. A German running the State Department, the Pentagon decisions, and the wars that we've been into, and the rearmament, and the weapon systems that getting ready for World War III by 1985. Fritz Kramer and the Pentagon had 2 proteges of absolute power. One's Alexander Haig, and one was Henry Kissinger. So Haig took over the White House, and Kissinger took over the National Security Council and then became Secretary of State. Kramer was sitting there in the Pentagon pulling the switches, and then what happened was that Nixon goes home with his head between his legs and recuperates financially, but not spiritually, I'm sure. Gerald Ford is the holdover while these people can retrench and set up their next strategy. But the chain of command, the thing that I wrote about in my article on the coup d'etat that was continuing, was true then and it's true now because it's 10 years later and you can look back at the continuity. What I said was happening indeed did happen, and I was writing it 10 years ago. As a matter of fact, at the press club, at the LA Press Club, this was in August the 8th, 1972. Right after the arrest, and as I say, the system began to become unglued by March of 73. I had a large chart behind me, and if any of you want it, I'll send it to you. You can write to me and send a self-addressed stamped envelope. My address is in the book, or you can write Box 22511, Carmel 93922. I'll give that to you if I remember at the end of the show. At the press conference in August, and this was just weeks after the arrest, I had a three-prong chart at the top, and the center was the White House with Richard Nixon, and under that, the CIA control of Mr. Martin. That was James McCord, 19 years with the CIA, and he was in charge of the 16-man emergency team if they had a coup with the walkie-talkies, and under him, Bernard Barker, who was in charge of the conduit of funds for Watergate and planning the violent demonstrations in Miami, similar to the ones in Chicago in 1968. On the left-hand side of the chart, I had John Mitchell, the chairman of the Re-Election Committee, and under him, G. Gordon Liddy, the former White House staff counsel, and under him, the Robert Bennett Associate, which is the public relations office across the street from the White House, where there was $10 million put in by the Howard Hughes Organization into the Mullen Associates for the takeover that was to take place at the time of the convention in 1972. Now, the Howard Hughes people had long been controlled by direct links to Nazi Germany. In the first Watergate article, I was linking Nixon to the Nazis. The public relations office of Carl Boyer, B-Y-O-I-R, ran the Howard Hughes organization, their public relation. Boyer was also the public relations for the Flick Company from Nazi Germany, Nazi criminals, and also they combined with J. Peter Grace, who recently got an appointment by Ronald Reagan to cut some more of your benefits and cut federal expenses off the back of the poor, and linked to Otto Ambrose and I.G. Farben. The money that went into Mullen Associates was directly linked to Nazi Germany, the present time, and the past Nazi Germany, and of course, G. Gordon Liddy with his German indoctrination to Hitler when he was younger through a housekeeper, and his love of Adolf Hitler fit right into the Mullen Associates with E. Howard Hunt and their close links to Richard Helms and his indoctrination in Nazi Germany. I had a diagram on the right-hand side of Charles Colson being the case officer for Mr. White, E. Howard Hunt, and I had a complete diagram within weeks of the Watergate arrest of the power structure as it was, and it hasn't changed that much. Recently, they're still in power. Now, March 19th, 1973, was the date that James McCord went before Judge Sirica and broke the story. He said that people wanted him to plead guilty and end the case, but he said, members of my family fear for my life. He was getting death threats from Mr. Caulfield and other people, and they also got the lesson of the Dorothy Hunt plane crash the December before. So there were primary witnesses of Watergate that were dying like flies, and I'll put some of those on the air for you next week in case you don't remember them. He told the judge there was political pressure to plead guilty, that people had perjured themselves, that other people were involved in Watergate that weren't identified, that the Watergate operation was not a CIA operation, that his motives were different than other people, and that he wanted to speak to the judge out of the chambers. He said, I can't talk with FBI people in the room. I can't talk before the grand jury, the U.S. attorneys, the Department of Justice. He told Judge Sirica, I don't trust any of them. Now, what made Watergate come unglued? A lot of people thought James McCord had left a piece of tape on. When one piece was removed, another tape was put back. James McCord was important in breaking it open for the judge, but who gained? Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig, who still have power today. McCord was different than the other people, but he not only worked for the CIA, he worked for the Department of Defense for the emergency 16-member emergency contingency. And at the time, Ronald Reagan out here had been charged with the Garden Plot and the coup d'etats that were planned. He was governor in California until 1974, 1968 to 74. And he had his finger, there's minutes of these meetings, on the planned coup d'etat, and that would have served him fine. He would have worked his way up eventually anyway. So the James McCord, an outsider, was breaking this story that was sure to get Richard Nixon out of the office, to bring in Gerry Ford and bring Haig into the White House, and the old team would move out. There was Butterfield working with Alexander Haig, and there was James McCord working with the Pentagon and the emergency unit, and he wanted to protect the CIA. He didn't want them to take all the blame, but he never fingered the Defense Department. But he was willing to break that story so that two people from the inside were breaking this story, and the house was falling down, and Richard Nixon was out of place, but the power structure stayed the same. Now, when James McCord went to testify, this was May the 17th, 1973, before Judge Sirica, he brought his counsel, Bernard Fensterwald. As I say, Fensterwald had been at my home before this all came down, and I had called him at the time they were arrested. There were three people that I was in touch with simultaneously while all this was happening. One was the experience with John and Yoko Lennon, who were victims of the system, who were to be deported while the top Nazis and murderers were to stay here. The other was Louis Tackwood, who had clued in to the people in the White House, and they, in fact, were the ones arrested, and I was in touch with him in Los Angeles, and Bernard Fensterwald, who became James McCord's attorney. So Watergate wasn't a phenomenon that I studied like the John Kennedy assassination, starting with from scratch, trying to figure things out for myself. I had already been on the air 1 year. I knew these characters that were involved. I knew where to look for the story, what they had done in the past. And that's why it was easy. It wasn't easy. It was hard to get the story together, but it was easier than most people because I was able to pull out the early Tackwood allegations from 1971 and was in touch with people who had a finger in the pie. Fensterwald knew what McCord was. He was a double agent who went around the country meeting researchers on the pretense that he ran a committee to investigate assassinations, but his links were closer to Carlos Marcello and Bobby Vesco than they were to truth, and he became McCord's attorney. Now, before the hearings in May, McCord made it very clear. He said that he wanted to open up this story, and he wanted more truths to come out. He said that the freedoms were involved, and he said, if it meant my freedom, if I had to go to jail, I would do it, but I wasn't going to see the CIA blamed. And then he went on to say that he would burn every tree in the forest. He threatened. He sent a letter to Jack Caulfield. He says, if this gets out of hand, if the Watergate case gets out of hand, I will burn every tree. He said, every tree in the forest will fall. It will be a desert. The whole matter is at the precipice right now. And that's the message. If you want to blow it, go on and do it. This is what he testified May the 17th, 1973, that if you want to push me too far, the operation will fall down and every tree in the forest will fall and it will be a desert. Now, McCord wasn't pushed. He only had 4 months in jail. He's now at Fort Collins, Colorado, which is an interesting phenomenon, but I won't digress to that right now. And he put on the line, don't mess around with me because I know what's going on for the last years. And when I wrote my article, I didn't know what he was threatening back there. I had published the article in August of 72, and this is May of 73, but I knew he went back with a long history of espionage and counterintelligence. And here's a fellow telling Judge Sirica, and on public television, it was recorded, his threats. And E. Howard Hunt said the same thing. He threatened, and this was quoted May 17th, 1973, at the hearings, Hunt purportedly threatened to blow the White House out of the water. Mrs. Hunt, at one point, repeated the statement and made it before E. Howard Hunt and said she had enough information to impeach the president. Well, Mrs. Hunt was blown up in a plane crash in December. She never got around to what she had. But she was threatening to impeach the president of the United States. And this is just days after their arrest. I'm busy in Carmel writing my article, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? And these dogs back there are really frantic. And it was fun later, after my published article came out, to read the Watergate hearings, to hear them on television, to read the transcripts, to read the books, because here's Richard Nixon thinking that it's deliberate. Here's Nixon pulling the rug out of Agnew. Here's the worrying that the Cubans are killers. He knows they are. He's thinking about Kennedy. He's thinking about himself. Hunt's threatening to blow the White House out of the water, and McCord is threatening to burn every tree in the forest. Now, what in the heck are they so worried about? I mean, five men caught at a hotel wiretapping a telephone. No, that couldn't be what it was at all. And nothing else in the last 10 years has pointed out the consistency of the people who planned the coup that Louis Tagwood talked about and how they did, in fact, take hold of this government in the past 10 years. As a matter of fact, in that first published article, I said the line of succession in this country was Richard Nixon, Spiro Agnew, and Ronald Reagan. Those were the three heirs to the Nazi regime from 1945, when the war was over. They were groomed for it, and we'll go many times, in the as I have in the past, in the future, giving you the exact dates of the takeover of when this country was sold out. So this strong language of these guys, the president, and there's hours of conversations, and he's pretty nervous. So we got him worried. We've got Haig taking over as chief of staff. Haldeman slipped out, and a general who passed over 243 people gets a big, fast promotion, and he's in there in the White House. Remember, nobody elected Kissinger. Nobody elected Haig. Here comes Gerald Ford out of nowhere, covering up the murder of a president of the United States. And here's a gang of crooks scrambling to cover their bases, but worried, threatening each other. And as I say, they weren't just threatening because some men were arrested, and one of them had the name White, and it was E. Howard Hunt in the White House. There were so many things coming unglued, and life threats to people, and people being murdered, like Beverly Kay, who typed up that 18-minute gap in the White House, and Murray Chotiner, the man behind both Richard Nixon and Chief Justice Earl Warren. There are a whole group of people, Lou Russell, who worked with the House on American Activities, who was killed. There were 30 deaths almost immediately, and the most frightening was the Dorothy Hunt crash. And later it came out that Tony Laskowitz was up at Chappaquiddick the night that Mary Jo Kopechne was killed, and that knocked Senator Ted Kennedy out of the chances of being a president of the United States. They could always bring this out. This gang was scrambling around, and I had published an article. Now, the L.A. Free Press, and I have copies here of newspaper articles from the L.A. Free Press, from San Francisco papers, from the Berkeley Barb. The counterculture, which we're missing today, there is no such thing as these little papers anymore where the truth could come out, like the L.A. Star. They all closed. The Berkeley Barb closed. The L.A. Star closed. The L.A. Free Press, the Boston papers, the Detroit papers, the Philadelphia. The alternative paper that's so badly needed is gone. And that's why it's always been a challenge to me and a responsibility for me to be on the air these 11 years, because this is practically the only continuing radio program of its kind probably in the world and in this country, trying to alert you to things that could be in the alternative press that were all closed up. And I hope that one thing that comes out of the anti-nuclear movement and the fear of World War III is that there will be the emergence of the small press again. Now, at the press conference in L.A., in addition to this chart, the subject was carried by Art Fine in the L.A. Free Press, and I'll give you some excerpts of what he was saying about the article, not what I said in my article, so you could see what he was saying in this 10 years ago, the anniversary of Watergate. He said, "Big news is coming out of Monterey Bay lately, but it isn't Monterey. A journalist living in Carmel has broken a story which could have reverberations around the world. Many people are concerned with conspiracies." He goes on, "There's some uncertainty, there's some skepticism, but in August 1982 in The Realist, she presented an article on the kidnapping of Martha Mitchell, the CIA participation in it, in the plans for civil disorders, for political assassinations." He mentions that Paul Krasner publishes The Realist, that he's usually a satirist, but he took this issue of The Realist and presented something serious, that she's on Saturday, and it mentioned the radio station in Carmel, California, had been on for a year. This article went into the Louis Tagwood allegations of the planned coup in this country of Mr. Martin and Mr. White, and May offered these opinions. Now, this was 10 years ago. One, the CIA plotted the murder of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and the shooting of George Wallace. Two, the CIA financed the 1967 military takeover in Greece as a practice run for similar takeover in the United States. Three, Lee Harvey Oswald was an agent of Navy intelligence. Four, the 600 Nazi agents were brought to the United States before the end of World War II and placed in defense and aerospace. I'm reading this to you because many of you don't realize when I talk about these things that 10 years ago, 10 years before 60 Minutes, on a radio station in this city and on other radio stations around the country, this program is taped for them. This is what I was publishing. The article said, the CIA is the device of an international conspiracy that is manipulating the policies of the United States and other countries. Now, of course, when Nixon was in power and Allende won the election in Chile, the orders of Kissinger and Allende were get him out, put Pinochet in. So you see, I was writing 10 years ago how we were doing coups, and I had a list up to that time. And then I was mentioning this was up till 1972, and goodness knows how many heads of states we've murdered since that time. I wrote that Martha Mitchell was detained and drugged by five men rather than her usual guard, that four men were at large at the time of the Watergate, and they could have been out there, and that L. Patrick Gray was staying out at the same place as the Mitchells simultaneously. Now, later it turned out that L. Patrick Gray was ordered to deep six and destroy papers about the Watergate that would have proved a much larger conspiracy. Maurice Stans, who's been appointed as a special commission job by Ronald Reagan, now was at the committee to reelect the president, shredding papers. The moving vans came in and took the files out of the White House that belonged to E. Howard Hunt, the Chappaquiddick files, the Diem files. They were scrambling around, and I was making allegations about these people while they were destroying their evidence. I wrote about the $10 million in funds that made its way into the CIA and then came back to the reelection of Richard Nixon. Now, there was an article in the New York Times, June the 10th, 1974. This is 2 years after my article, saying that the CIA had diverted millions of dollars of taxpayers' money to the political goal of reelecting the president. Now, I posed the question at the time of the press conference and in my article, if the CIA is pouring money into the president, tax dollars, and we don't choose him for a president, how can the people opposing him have equal money? If it goes into the till and then all the CIA people are putting it into his reelection, and that, in fact, was what was happening, and it was in the New York Times, the Sam Irvin panel, as I say, June 10th, 1974, from the General Services Administration, from the Office of Minority Business Enterprise. The minorities were supposed to be getting money for small businesses, and the money was diverted to the Richard Nixon supporters, so the minorities weren't getting it. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, money that was allocated to them 2 years later, it turned out, was going to the reelection of Richard Nixon and their criminal activities. And then this article goes on with some more allegations I made at the press conference. It was a fairly good analysis of what I said, and the essence was picked up by the LA Free Press. I give them credit for that. There was a wall of silence, of course, with the major media. The same people that were at that press conference, such as Leroy Ahrens from Washington Post, he covered the Lewis Tackwood allegations, and there was nobody to investigate what Tackwood said. Now, if anybody had followed his articles in the New York Times and Washington Post, and the purpose of Tackwood surfacing was to warn people that the government had literally been taken over by the intelligence agencies that wanted a coup d'etat in this country, that they would kill the president if necessary, round up the radicals, take them away. And here was a man who worked with the LAPD for many years. Lewis Tackwood, incidentally, is named after Louis Armstrong. That was his godfather, and he came from New Orleans. He even worked with Carlos Marcello, and he's no pansy or sissy. He was somebody to believe. He worked with Donald DeFries in the Los Angeles Police Department. That's how I happened to get the first scoop on my article, The SLA is the CIA, because Tackwood knew the story about that. As a matter of fact, in March of 1973, the Watergate story was in limbo. The men were going to plead guilty. My article was published and disseminated around the country. And Lewis Tackwood was here in Carmel, California. His book, The Glass House Tapes, was almost ready for the printer. Avon Publisher put it out. It's in a paperback, and it has the allegations about what was going to come down at the Republican conventions. As a matter of fact, he gave me the first copy they sent of approval for him to read it over, and for the publishers wanted him to see it, and he autographed it and gave it to me. And he was at my home March 1973 when he got a telephone call, and it was from Don Freed in L.A., that somebody from the Los Angeles Police Department clued him off they were going to kill him, because when McCord started talking, he had said that McCord was Mr. Martin. So they said, get out of town as fast as you can. We'd had dinner at Gallatin's here in town. I came home, cashed a check, and got $100 rounded up from family and friends and gave him one of my Rolly cameras. And he was here with his girlfriend, who he later married. And they got out of town as fast as they could, because when McCord broke the story, he thought he would be one of those first 30 that would be wiped out. There was evidence they were after him, and he got out of town. He took a bus and went down to New Orleans, where he had family, and stayed in hiding. And when the press conference came down in August of 72, earlier he was at the L.A. Press Club. He wasn't allowed to see me. The LAPD had sent orders, don't surface, don't confirm it, stay away, because the newspaper articles that made the connection of what he said in 1971 and what I wrote in 1972, if they saw the two of us together and challenged, how come he said this and it's in your papers and you didn't do anything about it, no one in Washington did anything, and here comes May months later and recognizes the names and writes this article. What is remiss between the reporters who took the stories and did nothing about it and the FBI or the CIA? Well, that's a redundant question. He was talking about a system that is so controlled that the major media locks it up. But the alternative press does expose a lot, or did. And as I say, it's a tragedy that we just don't have that kind of communication. There is a newsletter that Penn Jones has that's been going on all these years, a continuing inquiry. It's a great paper, one of the finest researchers since the day Kennedy was murdered. He has done constant work and dedicated his life to getting out the truth. And there were these other newspapers, too. He's still going. Penn's continuing inquiry is still available. And he also published in his Midlothian Mirror my entire Watergate story. So what I was presenting in that first article, my first published article after 8 years research, and it's 10 years anniversary since that, was that there was a plan to take over the government. This time they couldn't shoot Nixon. And next week I'll go into the man, Andrew Topping, who was hired to shoot Nixon. They did indeed plan that, and Dwight Chapin, the appointment secretary, had approved. He was interviewed. The Secret Service had come to see him. I wrote about Andrew Topping as a man who had an appointment to see Richard Nixon, who could kill him. And just a month ago, Andrew Topping's name was in the news. He was arrested again, and he has a 7-year-old son that he is training to be a mass murderer for the government and the intelligence community. And he tortures and persecutes this little kid and is training him like a Hitler youth for future assassinations. A case of a woman being turned down and turning in Andrew Topping occurred. And 10 years later, his name surfaces in the news. And I published that 10 years ago as a man who had an appointment. And Howard Hunt had a gun in the White House. And it was all a cozy connection. Now, next week, I'm going to do a little bit more about the allegations that I said about Watergate. And then I'm going to update it with what, in fact, did actually happen, to show you that, in all modesty, I was exactly on target, and they didn't have to kill Richard Nixon. The power structure took over very nicely. They put the tape there. They slid him out. They got in the very people they wanted. Carter was a holdover, a man from Annapolis who held over till Ronald Reagan could be in the seat. But the blueprint of Tackwood and the article I did 10 years ago happened, and these are the people that are in power today. They did it nicely, Mr. McCord, Mr. Butterfield, Mr. Haig, and now Haig is Secretary of State. Well, this is all for my first evening over here in Pacific Grove. I'll have to get used to the new, it's hard to change a station after so long, but I think it'll be great, and I'm glad to be here, and thank you for the opportunity. In the meantime, this is Mae Brussel in Pacific Grove, and I'll be back with you next week. We'll be right back.
Well, good evening out there, kids, and it's time for the blues.